Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner. I'm your host, Trey Walsh, and today we have on the show CK. Now, many of you will know CK. He was the former COO at Bitcoin Magazine, and now he is the director of the Financial Freedom Team over at the Human Rights Foundation, an organization that we share a lot of on our social media and have talked about on our show before. We've had Aylin, we've had Alex Gladstein on the show, folks like that, and cannot talk about this organization enough and the awesome work they do there. And all of the information on their organization and what CK is doing with them is in our show notes, by the way. I'll mention that first and foremost for you to check out. But this was such a great conversation. It was really kind of just a pulse check on where Bitcoin is right now. You know, there's been a lot of conversations on Bitcoin Twitter, on different things about ordinals and spam filters and talking about technology. We talk about, as the title suggests, Bitcoin as a paradigm shift and mental models coming into Bitcoin. And different groups and people thinking about, you know, what is Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin money? Is Bitcoin something more? You know, we get into all of it. And CK is really one of my favorite thinkers in the space about this. And I think comes at this in a very humble and open way that a lot of us should try to emulate in terms of the way we think about Bitcoin. You know, there's a lot of things that we do not know and do not know what things will look like in the next few decades of Bitcoin. And just a reminder to people, we are so early in terms of Bitcoin, in terms of its adoption phase, in terms of its ability as an open permissionless network. It's only 15 years old. So a lot of things for people to remember and think about from this episode. And thank you so much, CK, for coming on and spending some time talking with me about all of these things. I think people will really enjoy and resonate with that. And as always, if you have any feedback on the show or want to get in touch with me, you can reach out at hello@progressivebitcoiner.com. And before we jump into the show, don't forget to check out our promo links to all of our sponsors. So shout out to Zeus, to Bitbox, and to Saz Mining. You can check out all of our sponsor promo links in the show notes. And as always, please feel free to look into our Substack newsletter. That's a weekly newsletter. And it's one of the best ways to support us at the Progressive Bitcoiner as well. You can become a paid subscriber to get early access to the show, as well as our Geyser Fund, which is kind of like a Bitcoin GoFundMe for those that haven't heard of Geyser before. We've got TPB shirts on there. We've got different rewards. It's a way that you can support and donate through Lightning to our show. We would really appreciate that. And thank you for everyone that has supported the show so far. All right. I will let you get to the episode now, and we will see you again next week. Hey, CK, welcome to the Progressive Bitcoiner. How are you?
Trey, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to chat.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for your time. And I know I, you know, sent over a few things for us to chat about and was mentioning to you, you know, this conversation at kind of this pivotal time before the halving, with a lot of things going on in Bitcoin and Bitcoin community, you know, protocol, Lightning, just so many different things going on in the space. Feels like a really good time to chat with you and check in on things in general. So really been looking forward to this conversation. But before we jump in too much, for those that don't know who you are, do you want to give a little background, who you are, you know, what you've been up to in the space?
Yeah, thanks for that intro. And yeah, I consider myself the luckiest guy in Bitcoin. I've had the privilege of being around Bitcoin since 2017. Since getting into Bitcoin, I got to work at Bitcoin Magazine and you know, spent 5.5 years there. My last role there was the COO. And now I get to work at the HRF alongside Alex Gladstein and run the Financial Freedom Team. So I'm repping my Financial Freedom hat right here. But yeah, I'm the director of financial freedom at the HRF right now, and just working on so many incredible projects like the Bitcoin Development Fund and others. So excited to jump in.
Yeah, and for those that follow us on social media and stuff, you know, we've shouted out HRF quite a bit, including all of those projects that you mentioned, so people can see that. Well, you know, we'll have all of this in the show notes as well. So definitely, please explore all of that. You know, first and foremost. Once you get done listening to this episode. And yeah, I remember, you know, a while ago now, how long has it been now that you've been at, it's been at least 6-8 months longer that you've been over at HRF now?
Yeah, pretty much. I started in October.
Okay. Yeah. It feels like so long, but yeah, I guess the fall. So for you, I mean, I was super excited to see that. I think, you know, coming into the space, one of the first people that I really got hooked into Bitcoin because of what they were talking about was Alex Gladstein. And I know that's the case for quite a few people, and hearing the human rights angle of Bitcoin. And obviously we talk about a lot of that on this show. I talk to most of my friends in like normie land. I talk to about the human rights stuff because I just think it's like the most compelling thing for me that hooked me into Bitcoin. Obviously there's a lot of different things. So seeing some of my favorite people in Bitcoin slowly get pulled into the HRF world and see those two things coexist really, really well has been really exciting for me. So what for you, obviously you knew Alex, you knew HRF, you know, coming into this, what has that been like for you now being there for, you know, since October and exploring Bitcoin and exploring this new role, given the background you had going into this, what has this been like for you?
Oh man, it's been an absolute pleasure and just such a massive honor that Alex trusted me to run the Financial Freedom team. It's really his kind of his baby and his brainchild. But Alex and I actually have a pretty long and I think pretty fruitful working relationship. While I was at Bitcoin Magazine, I actually helped him along with many other folks publish their books. As well as publish Alex's incredible kind of like unveiling of these human rights stories around Bitcoin on Bitcoin Magazine. So, you know, we've had, I would say, a working relationship since 2020. I think that is why, you know, when it was time for me to move on from Bitcoin Magazine, Alex jumped on that opportunity to bring me on board. And it's been, you know, Bitcoin Magazine is very much like a Bitcoiner run organization. And HRF, while we do an incredible amount of things around Bitcoin, HRF has been technologically innovative for a long time, you know, not just restricted to Bitcoin, but in other elements of cryptography, using flash drives and mesh networking and other tools in order to help activists in you know, dire conditions, you know, so they aren't like necessarily 100% a Bitcoin oriented organization through and through like Bitcoin Magazine. So it's been a journey to really get to know everyone, get to know all the programs that they're operating in, get to know how the organization prioritizes itself and its work. And, you know, just getting the access to the type of people that HRF operates with, it's just been such an immense pleasure. And I mean, we can dive into all the different programs and stuff like that, that HRF is a part of, but being able to push forward what we're doing on the Bitcoin side and align it with Bitcoiners and help on the operation side and help scale Alex's genius, it's just been a lot of fun over the past like 8 months or so.
Yeah, and I think if anything, there's such a natural marriage, and I really, really enjoy seeing more organizations and more activists and more folks tap into Bitcoin as a tool, not necessarily Bitcoin as the conference community thing, Bitcoin Maxi Club, right? Like in that mm-hmm. way, like seeing it more as this tool that's okay, we're kind of growing and maturing, right? Like Bitcoin is still so totally young, and we totally want to talk about that and get into it. Can't emphasize enough how young it is when people want to criticize it or talking about it. I'm like, this monetary revolution is 15 years old, for crying out loud. It's so young, and looking at what it's already developed since I got in 2021, not to mention since its birth, is absolutely amazing. But seeing it as this like tool so people can access it without having to have read every Bitcoin book or being on Bitcoin mm-hmm. Twitter or all of these things, which all fine and dandy, that's really cool to me. That's, I feel like, that next wave that we're entering into. So it was really cool to see you make that jump and do that. Cause I think that's like, you know, just a really good, sense and signal for folks of like, this is where Bitcoin is going and headed. And these are the stories we're telling. It's so important, I think.
Yeah. I think you make a really good point. And, you know, folks who are, on Bitcoin Twitter or on Noster, they know me as the guy who's always telling people that they're not bullish enough. And I think that a lot of that is rooted in recognizing how early we are. But with that being said, also recognizing like the massive growth that Bitcoin will continue to experience given how much it's achieved in such short amount of time. And one of my favorite mental models to think about Bitcoin is from the perspective of like a young promising athlete. So it's really around like 10 or 11 where you can identify like, wow, this athlete has something special. And then, you know, they start really implementing and instrumenting their dominance 15, 16. But it's not really until, you know, their early 20s that they kind of get to that peak of their athletic ability. And typically, if it's a real star, you know, a Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant-esque, you know, they're dominant for many years after kind of reaching adulthood. So I really like to think about Bitcoin from that mental model. And, you know, Bitcoin's 15 years old right now. We're about to get to its fourth halving. There's 32 total halvings. You know, this beast is just beginning to really implement itself. And I just think that, you know, when Bitcoin's 21, when Bitcoin's 25, when Bitcoin's 30, you know, let's see how it fares in the monetary battlegrounds that, you know, it's operating in right now.
Yeah, I never thought about the halving in that way until this moment. I'm like embarrassed to admit. It's like we're only 4 out of, what did you say, 32, like around, you know, 2100, whatever it is. That's wild to think about. Because yeah, I think so many people think about like, oh, Bitcoin is mature right now, right? We've got the ETFs, we've got Wall Street, all this stuff coming up. I think we're going to look back in 20 years, like you're saying, and feel a little bit silly about saying how mature and how, okay, yeah. I mean, and for some people, especially the, you know, the bears out there that think Bitcoin will fail all of this, they're like, oh, Bitcoin has hit its peak, right? This, and so I think this conversation will be for those folks that are like, oh, it's hit its peak. And it's like, I think folks that have studied it for a little bit, you know, it's kind of wild. The more I study it, the less sure I am about its future, but in a really cool way, in a really inspiring way. One of the things I wanted to ask you too, and then we'll get into, is like even saying what is Bitcoin is getting more complex for me in a lot of different ways. You know, and all of these debates that folks have had going on for a while now, I think spearheaded by Peter at what Bitcoin did, just for the average person listening into podcasts and Bitcoin podcasts, talking about, you know, what are ordinals? What is Bitcoin? What is money? All of these different things. Yeah, I'm definitely on the money side of Bitcoin, I think, in a lot of these things. But it does get a bit more complex with this invention that Satoshi put into the world, that's open source, that's continuing to be built out and built on. What is Bitcoin is going to be a really, at least for me, a tricky question to answer and communicate to people over time. So yeah, I guess why don't we jump into that with, you know, thinking about these things, thinking about how early we are with Bitcoin. When you think about what is Bitcoin, and sorry for that leading question there, what is that like to think about for you? Some people will very specifically say, you know, it's this open ledger, it's this data system. Some people say it's better money, this and that. Like, how do you, I'm curious to see how you think through a question like that. Like, what is Bitcoin, and what will Bitcoin be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of ways to kind of think about what is Bitcoin. I would say at the most fundamental level, Bitcoin is a distributed compute network. So it's distributed. It's a physical, real network of real computers that are connected to each other. And that network is governed by consensus rules. And the best way I like to think about consensus rules is like, think of a game that is global, like chess. So anyone can sit down together and play chess together, even if they don't speak the same language, as long as they know the rules. But let's say you, Trey, you want to change what the queen can do and what the king can do. All of a sudden, you sit down with someone, can't compute. You can't play chess with them if you're operating by different rules. So it's a physical compute network that uses consensus rules, similar to like the game, the rules of chess, that are universally known, and it automates those rules. So computers are the ones that are maintaining that consensus. So that's kind of like a technical way about thinking about it, but it's also like it reduces out all these other labels. That is actually what it is, this kind of compute network. And because of the rules and because of the way that it's architected, it is permissionless to operate within that consensus. If you internalize what that means, it means that what will emerge out of those rules are unknown. I also kind of think about Bitcoin kind of like gravity, where it's, you know, we've been living with gravity, all of humanity, this entire planet, all of physics operates within the rules of gravity. But what we're able to do within the rules of gravity is constantly elevating, right? You know, at first, humans were bound to the ground. You know, now we're flying. Now we're shooting telescope, or now we're shooting satellites into space. You know, people are attempting to get into different gravity wells. People are attempting space travel. We're building skyscrapers with steel higher than we've ever done before. Humans have always pushed the boundaries on what is possible within the consensus, the physical realities of gravity. And that is also true with Bitcoin. I like to think about Bitcoin, again, it's only a 15-year-old project. What that means is that the oldest and most experienced Bitcoin developers at most have 15 years of Bitcoin development experience. Well, when we get to 32 halvings completed, we're going to have three generations of Bitcoin developers trained by Bitcoin developers, right? Like the amount of knowledge, experience, understanding of what can be done within the parameters of this network in this these consensus rules, we're just starting to break the surface there. So ultimately, you know, I think that people need to be very, very open-minded to what can and will happen within consensus. So that's generally my mental framework there, is that we're at the beginning, there's a physical permissionless network, and that we are just beginning to understand how to manage and operate within those consensus rules.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think one of the things, because I think so much of what I've seen you posting, writing about, talking about, I just find myself naturally, I feel like in alignment with a lot of that, in alignment with a lot of, and maybe it's a bit of the notion of, you know, I came into Bitcoin like this humanities kid, like focusing on like sociology. I'm really fascinated by people groups, religion, and, you know, Bitcoin has a bit of that. Any movement has some of that. So I started writing on those type of things, really interested in that, because I was like, that's my niche, right? I'm not a technologist. I play around with different things. I learned how to run like a Lightning Note, you know, all these. I just kind of like learned how to do some of that and play around with it because I cared. But naturally, I came from that realm. So just thinking of how, you know, people groups come together and some of the conflicts that arise out of these things, red, you know, the block size wars, just figuring out how people think about this. So, you know, Bitcoin is this protocol. It has these rules. There's also a lot of people running nodes, developers, miners that you know, Bitcoin is folks using Bitcoin out in the community as well. So I guess the pushback that I've found myself wrestling with a bit more the past couple of weeks, you know, we have the consensus, the rules, and we're like, this is it. Who's to say what that will look like, how people will in consensus build on this or do whatever. Do you think or do you feel there's any obligation from users or people that are using Bitcoin within Bitcoin, calling themselves Bitcoin or whatever it is, to hold some sort of core ethos to what Bitcoin is? Does that make sense? Because I feel like there's a lot of conversation around this right now. There probably has been for a while. And in the foreseeable future? Or do you think, listen, this is an open protocol. People can build as they will, as long as they're following the rules, and it's a pretty conservative system. Like, how do you think through that? Because I'm starting to think or test my own assumptions and be like, should there be a central ethos? Because Bitcoin does and doesn't need us. I go back and forth with that quite a bit. Like, how do you think about that?
Well, I would say that the physical Bitcoin network operates on game theoretical incentives. And if those incentives are broken, then the system is going to fail and Bitcoin's going to go to zero. I typically have three mental models about thinking about Bitcoin. Or not three mental models, but like three outcomes that I think are like three logical outcomes for Bitcoin. So outcome number one is Bitcoin is a paradigm shift in money and compute, and that is like the Bitcoin is infinity divided by 21 million. And I would argue that if Bitcoin's actually a paradigm shift, then it'll actually create the opportunity for more growth, more wealth, more prosperity. So it actually makes infinity bigger. So if it actually is infinity divided by 21 million, then no one is bullish enough. This is why I really try to push people, like, you know, our little monkey brains in this medieval current world, you know, it's not possible for us to grok what a paradigm shift is going to bring to the world. Similar to if you were living in the Dark Ages in Europe, like 1,000 years into the future, you were like, not one person on the planet could actually express accurately what was going to go down, that we're going to be flying around in tubes that we call airplanes, that, you know, I just played golf and I have like an app and it tracks where every single hit goes. It tracks my handicap in real time. Like all of this, like no one was even contemplating like those possibilities. So that's how I describe Bitcoin as a paradigm shift. It's not only infinity divided by 21 million, but it actually makes infinity bigger. Logical outcome number two is the incentives break and it fails. The shitcoiners and the haters are right. And Bitcoin goes to zero. I think that there has to be room for that. Like, it is a game theoretic distributed compute network. So if the game theory breaks down, like there's a good chance that this thing fails. And then logical outcome number three, which I think the majority of people, they actually use this logical outcome as their mental model, which is why I push people to say like they're not bullish enough, is because Bitcoin, it's this idea that Bitcoin is just another asset amongst assets. So it's like Bitcoin exists, but it's not a paradigm shift. Maybe it's like this niche tech that, you know, a very few amount of people are going to use, but it's not actually going to, you know, get mass adoption. I personally think that's the least likely scenario, but it's good to categorize it and understand it. And I think it's good to understand that, that's what the majority of people are kind of using as their mental model, because it's the current paradigm. You know, if like, it's pretty much saying Bitcoin is not a paradigm shift. It's just an asset that exists, right? So the current paradigm will persist, which is that, you know, you can invest in real estate, you can invest in gold, you can invest in other cryptocurrencies. You know, all of these things are going to like coexist in the world. So I think that's the least likely scenario. So I think it's like important to kind of just like think through what this system actually means and what it could and like what could amount from it. And then when I think about like what are the possibilities here and why are we Bitcoining and how can we preserve Bitcoin in this ethos? Well, from the perspective of hyper Bitcoinization, Bitcoin goes to zero, or the current paradigm persists. Thinking that like this small group of people on the internet are going to like maintain some sort of ethos that's going to scale to hyper Bitcoinization, it doesn't make sense to me. It's either Bitcoin's a paradigm shift, and that, you know, it's beyond our ethos, right? It's like a force of nature. I would say like that's the theory that's described in The Sovereign Individual, is that these technological shifts, you know, get discovered and then humanity coalesces around the new logic of violence, the new logic of how the universe works, or it's not. And if it's not, you know, maybe it will fail. Maybe, you know, it requires a core ethos, a centralized ethos to maintain it. But that's not really what I signed up for, honestly. Like, I think, you know, a lot of people are kind of wrestling with like, what is Bitcoin and what is required for it to succeed? And I would say that like, if Bitcoin isn't a paradigm shift, it's probably not going to be successful. Like if Bitcoin isn't a paradigm shift, then yeah, it will probably require like a small group of people to maintain like a hardline ethos. But I personally think that Bitcoin's a sound money and that it is a paradigm shift in value and compute and the way that we, you know, communicate and operate as humanity. And that goes way, way beyond what any of us or any small community of us can control. You know, a lot of the people that we're talking to right now, they are English speaking Bitcoiners on the internet. Right. But the majority of users, the vast majority of users of Bitcoin don't fit into that category. So like when you're arguing about Bitcoin and the money ethos, the NFT ethos, all of these kind of the degens, like all of these things, you know, you're not even reaching the vast majority of people. Like how many people in your network are in the Chinese speaking Bitcoin community? How many people in your network are in the Swahili speaking Bitcoin community? So I really do think like, if Bitcoin is like this life-changing, humanity-changing thing, it's that scenario number one. And if that is the case, like, it is way beyond any sort of central ethos. Like, that's frivolous.
This episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner is brought to you by Zeus. Zeus is a self-custodial Bitcoin wallet for Android and iOS. The app features a built-in Lightning node that allows you to take full control of how you make payments on-chain and on Lightning. You can easily onboard to the Lightning network and let Zeus's Lightning service provider, Olympus, do all the heavy lifting for you. Or you can get more hands-on and curate your own Lightning channels with whoever you transact with most. Zeus has best-in-class privacy and allows you to have great peace of mind when sending and receiving Lightning payments. Not only does the Zeus team not want to know how you're using your money, but they're building things in a way that they can't know. There's also a first-of-its-kind Lightning address that will allow you to receive payments 24/7 to your mobile wallet self-custodially. This is a great solution for a range of people, for those who just want to have the technical ability to set up their own infrastructure, to the nomads and dissidents that need to accept donations on the move. Other Lightning wallets don't give the users this level of control. In fact, many of them operate more like bank accounts that can be revoked and ultimately lead to you losing your money. With Zeus, you're in full control of your private keys and therefore can start to take full control of your financial destiny. Save 5% on LSP fees using code TPB in the access code under LSP settings. To learn more and to learn where to download, head to zeusln.com. Yeah, I think that that's a really important message for everyone to hear, especially people that are listening to English speaking Bitcoin podcasts. Like that's so true. And the more I talk to human rights activists and just had the privilege to connect with so many folks, especially over the past year, you know, I bang my head against the wall a little bit, whether it's with those online communities or whether it's to myself about the way I'm limiting my thoughts about Bitcoin, or I'm not checking my financial privilege or checking my privilege in whatever case. Because I think you're exactly right. A lot of these conversations or arguments are hitting 5% of users. And I would agree with that hyper-Bitcoinization, Bitcoin mass adoption, all these different things, trajectory, and would say, you know, I don't know. I guess you could say like it would fail if it didn't reach that, because I would say that's optimal. That's Bitcoin reaching its full potential. Others, I think someone like Larry Fink would say, hey, the ETF's good enough for us, right? Do you think mental model number three that you mentioned has a smaller percentage of happening now that the ETFs are here? Or do you think the ETFs truly are a Trojan horse getting us more towards model number one that you mentioned?
We're very early in this revolution. I subscribe to Bitcoin as a paradigm shift. And as part of that, like, Bitcoin has to eat the world. And I think that the ETFs are absolutely a mechanism for that happening. I recently went on the Stefan Levera podcast and I was arguing everything is good for Bitcoin because Bitcoin is an anti-fragile system. It's architected to be an anti-fragile system, which means that it benefits from the punches. Not to say that Bitcoin's not going to get punched. It's just that it gets, you know, what doesn't kill it makes it stronger. I absolutely think the ETFs are a really powerful tool for getting capital that's stuck in specific areas into Bitcoin. Obviously, the ETFs have trade-offs. Folks who are purchasing ETFs, you know, they're not actually owning real Bitcoin. Most likely, you know, in the future, if Bitcoin continues to accelerate as peer-to-peer digital cash, the ETF instruments are going to be viewed as like wrappers that actually prevent you from leveraging the asset fully. But it's definitely a positive middle ground. And it's definitely pushing Bitcoin forward in terms of making it more accessible, getting people to have more skin in the game. And hopefully those people are going to experience the Bitcoin technology now that they have skin in the game. Maybe they'll rub shoulders with Bitcoin philosophers and thinkers and theorists on the internet more. And, you know, they'll be more open-minded to the paradigm shift that I think Bitcoin actually is.
And when you say Bitcoin paradigm shift, you know, we're not a show that does a lot of like, you know, I don't know if I'll do specific episodes on, let's do, you know, the case for ordinals, the case for spam filters, that, you know, this and that. But I think a lot of what you're talking about, I'm curious how you view those very in arguments right now in in Bitcoin Twitter in whatever, in terms of some folks are going as extreme as saying like a new civil war, a new, you know, kind of block size war 2.0, whatever. You know, how do you view that conversation? Just from what you're saying and what I've seen you put out, it almost seems like that argument of like Bitcoin needs to eat everything, like everything is good for Bitcoin in terms of these conversations. And maybe it's not necessarily about NFTs or this cat picture, but it's about what these conversations are opening up about what Bitcoin is. Is that the way you're approaching these things and kind of view it from that angle? Do you think there are case in points to either side here? I'm curious your thoughts expanding beyond just this, the things I've seen you post about with these very, very heated dynamics of, you know, and folks pretending there's only two camps on this too, which, you know, we do that with everything, right? And Bitcoin's no exception to that.
Well, I find myself like in the middle of the camps, but I would say like the really upset people on the filter side, you know, they like to lump me into let's call it like the pro NFT camp. Personally, when I think about Bitcoin, there is Bitcoin, and then there are our narratives and mental models around Bitcoin. And then when our narratives and mental models around Bitcoin start to diverge from like the known reality of the network, then there's really two choices for us as individuals: change our mental model and adapt, or become increasingly deranged as our commitment to our narrative continues to break down in the face of reality. So when I think through the block size wars, you know, I think of two camps of hardened Bitcoin enthusiasts. One camp aligned with the status quo and the reality of the network as it was, you know, becoming clear that the settlement network is not going to be able to handle massive amount of throughput and is going to have, you know, high costs to write to gain write access to the ledger. And then another camp that was unwilling to accept that, and their mental model increasingly diverged from the status quo, and their behavior and actions were increasingly deranged. The funny thing, and I think that Bitcoin's very poetic, and karma is a bitch, if you will, but now a lot of the people who are, let's say, right about the status quo around Bitcoin as a settlement network, the store of value, functionality, and properties of Bitcoin, many of those people's narratives are now starting to greatly diverge from the realities of the network. And we're starting to see they're lashing out in increasingly deranged ways. So I know it's tough to say that, you know, they're deranged, but the reality is that there's a status quo, and then those who are opposed to the status quo. And it really doesn't matter what the actual narrative is. Like, it doesn't matter if I was the righty on the small block size perspective and that I was right about the store of value, because when your narrative starts to diverge from the reality of the network, like, you're the person who's not aligned, right? The network just is. It's a distributed network within, you know, that maintains consensus. So people have to grapple with that. And, you know, what I increasingly try to remind people of is that, you know, that is the case. When we're talking about ordinals, NFTs, investment advice, monetary maximalism, all these kind of ideas, there's only one reality of the network. And in that reality of the network, inscriptions are possible. And a lot of the arguments that I'm seeing, like, opposed to those, one, they like mix up terms heavily, right? So like they use very imprecise language. And one of those terms that, you know, I hear, you know, you mentioned Peter McCormick, not to call him out, but I hear him using incorrectly, is this idea of monetary maximalism. So a lot of the ways that people who are, let's say, opposed to non-monetary uses of Bitcoin emerging, they say, I'm a monetary maximalist, therefore I prescribe that Bitcoin is a monetary network and we should only, thou shalt only use it for money, right? But that's not even what monetary maximalism is. Monetary maximalism is actually descriptive. It's a description of the economics of Bitcoin. So in the economics of Bitcoin, the more data that you're putting into the blockchain, the higher the cost. So therefore, if you are doing non-monetary transactions, the weight and density of those transactions are going to be lower, and it will actually cost more in order to per byte in order to put that data on the blockchain. Whereas a monetary transaction, it's pure value. There's no other BS attached to that transaction. So it is denser and will be able, you know, per pound, data per data, will be able to outbid at scale non-monetary transactions. And then as the system develops, that's just the case of settlement on the blockchain, is this description of how the economics work. So when I hear, Bitcoiners say, like, thou shalt not do these things because they're bad, like, but they're possible, right? And currently, like, settlement on Bitcoin's unfairly cheap. Like, you can get shipping gold across the planet level settlement for cents on the dollar, for nothing. So it's not like a final end state of Bitcoin is where we're at right now. And what I would say is, like, what's actually happening with, you know, people putting arbitrary data on the Bitcoin blockchain, calling them NFTs, creating, you know, a secondary market for those NFTs and trading them, whatever that is, that is really just setting a price floor, right? And these price floors on settlement on the Bitcoin network are going to continue to increase as the reality of what we have in front of us, this ultimate settlement network, becomes more and more acknowledged and more used. And if you actually believe in monetary maximalism, if monetary maximalism is an accurate description of how Bitcoin works, then the monetary transactions will ultimately price out the non-monetary transactions. So monetary maximalism is a description. It's not a prescription. So it's either an accurate description, even today, or it's an inaccurate description. And if it's an inaccurate description, then we should come up with more accurate descriptions for Bitcoin. Not say, I'm a monetary maximalist, so I believe that this is how we should behave, right? It's a description of how the economics works, not how our morality should be, right? Not like what is just or right. So that is like a confusion point that a lot of Bitcoiners have right now. And like, this is why I would argue that this whole debate is actually healthy, because people are clearly confused and we need to get to the bottom of it, right? And people either need to rage quit or they need to adjust their mental model to fit the reality of the network.
Yeah, gosh, there's so many good nuggets in what you just said, and so many questions that came to my mind. I think one of the things I noticed, which is really, really interesting, and I really do just coincidentally, I think, agree with a lot of what you're saying. And when I came in 2021, even, it was right after the high. I think it went back down to 30K or something like that. I'm like, all right, I'm going to just from a practical standpoint, I was like, I'm going to jump in now in terms of buying. I think I bought on Coinbase or whatever the case is. Initially. But I saw a lot of maxi accounts talking about, you know, oh, well, these, you know, NFTs and these shit coins that are whatever going to die because Bitcoin's going to be doing this anyway, going to be eating it anyway. So I saw that. That was 3 years ago. I remember seeing that. Like, I will show the, you know, whatever. This isn't that long ago. Then today.
That was definitely a narrative.
Yeah, those same people are like, how, no, this is not what Bitcoin's for. We can't allow this, spam filters, this and that. So for me, the first point is hypocrisy. It doesn't look good in terms of your argument to start there for folks seeing that. So then it leads me to think more into the, and I don't mean this pejoratively or anything, but when you were saying that derangement syndrome, it's clinging to that ideology or that thought of Bitcoin. You're completely going against what you thought. So yeah, the shit coiners, the Udis, the whoever are going to call you out for that, are going to troll on that more. And again, so it's just hard to hold up that argument. So that's one thought that I had that doesn't help in their case in a lot of ways. Secondly, to play devil's advocate a little bit.
I agree with you on that. Just to like add on is like the filterers can't change Bitcoin. The only thing that they can do is destroy their reputation and their credibility by continuing to advocate for something that is against the status quo. And if you zoom back to the block size wars, that's exactly what happened. Like Roger Ver went from the most credible person in Bitcoin to the least credible person in Bitcoin. We saw tons of companies destroy their credibility and you know, by clinging on to business models that just would not that could not operate within the realities of the network. So the real argument here is a credibility argument, not even like a let's change Bitcoin argument. Like you can't change Bitcoin. You won't be able to change Bitcoin outside of what is possible within consensus.
Yeah. And I do agree with that. I think I'm saying I agree with that. And then to play devil's advocate, I think some of these folks have come to that conclusion of, okay, you know, it's a valid transaction. It's allowable. All of these things, right? I think part of where the conversation gets tricky, and you've already kind of said we shouldn't approach it this way, is they're like, but that wasn't what Bitcoin was meant for. Can you please not do that? Can you do it in this way instead of that way? Kind of the my precious argument with Bitcoin, which I can understand because part of me, and I have to check myself a little bit, that appeals to me in a certain way, right? A lot of these people would be some of the first to trash on me as like this progressive, this vegan, this whatever, you know, fiat, whatever this and that I've heard all before, right? But in terms of like how I view Bitcoin, what I use Bitcoin for, the worldwide good around some of my thoughts on readings from Satoshi and emails and all of these early people into Bitcoin, I see what was being built at the time. Like this peer-to-peer cash system, this sound money, I see these arguments that are floating in that these people personally believe and that they find through Bitcoin or the way they understand the network. Do you think there's any, how do I phrase this? I don't want to say validity, but any appeal to that argument of Bitcoin was meant for blank. This is what Bitcoin should be. You guys are attacking Bitcoin, can you please not do that? Because that's a leading from what I've heard.
Yeah,
and people can call me out on this. I feel like that is
the white paper said is peer-to-peer cash, right? And in 2017 and before then, that was a very strong argument for why we should increase the block size. So appeals to authority is not what Bitcoin's about. That's just not how the network works. So you know, I've seen lots of people who were small blockers who made that argument when the big blockers, the people who wanted to change the status quo, instead of calling them small blockers, people who were okay with the status quo and created mental models and business models that aligned with the status quo of the network as we knew it in 2015 through 2017, those people constantly called out the fact that appeals to authority is not how Bitcoin works, and that the narratives created even in the title of the white paper, the founding document of Bitcoin, won't necessarily align with Bitcoin's reality into the future. So again, like what I would say is now we're seeing a lot of those same people become deranged and start to use the same appeals to authority. And they are grappling with the fact that their narratives and their mental model no longer aligns with the reality of the network. And, you know, there's really two choices because Bitcoin is not going to change for you. It's you can change your mental model or you can get pissed. But hey, asking people to do something is not scalable. You can't ask in enough languages. Your message can't reach enough people. And then ultimately, how are you going to enforce it? I mean, you could put filters on your own node. You can control your own node. You can't control the whole network. Like that is like, that's the change that Bitcoin is bringing to the world, right? Is that there's this network that's a physical network of compute that is in consensus with each other. And if you go out of the consensus, like that's your problem, not consensus's problem.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think a close second question in mind, because I hear this a lot too from friends, from people I trust and respect in Bitcoin. And I hear, and I think my point on this would be we're not there yet with scaling solutions, but some people would say, let's say hypothetically, you know, block fees and just fees in general with sending and receiving Bitcoin just skyrocket. Like they had a few months ago, but let's say it stays that way and even higher middle of this year, right? In ways we're not prepared for, in ways Lightning isn't prepared for, or Cashew or other, or Liquid, you know, other things, right? And I know each of them have their own solutions in handling this, but clearly peer-to-peer payments are still a work in progress in terms of some ideal situations for a billion plus people in Bitcoin. Like we could not properly handle that today, much less in a self-custodial way. How would you talk to people about that, especially considering, because they'd say, you know, CK, you work at HRF, you're focusing on financial freedom. How can someone who has, you know, a dollar spare per week from their paycheck afford to use Bitcoin to send, receive, to interact with the network, in light of this, right? If they're viewing, oh, NFTs, and this is all spam and it's causing fees to spike, right? How would you talk to someone about that? Because I hear that quite a bit from people, especially on the human rights angle, especially on the Global South angle of Bitcoin as money and peer-to-peer and the dangers of only using Wallet of Satoshi and things like this.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're in the very early stages of Bitcoin. And I would say like the technology surrounding Bitcoin is only going to get to where it needs to be if it's operating under realistic conditions. So if we build business models and we make recommendations and create solutions that are not physically possible within Bitcoin, we have two choices. Change those models and recommend models that actually work, or recommend something that's going to fail, destroy our credibility, and then keep people disappointed. You know, in 2015, Microsoft, Newegg, and all these e-commerce solutions were taking on-chain Bitcoin transactions. They were led by false narratives, and then they actually dropped all that and set ourselves back significantly. And the people who were like, oh my gosh, Bitcoin is this peer-to-peer solution, now we're losing all these merchants, they were like, okay, well, let's change Bitcoin so we can align, you know, keep these merchants on board. But their solutions were broken to begin with. They were never going to scale to begin with. So we need solutions that work under realistic environments within the reality of Bitcoin. And we need to make recommendations that make sense. So maybe in this intermediate phase, like, we need to find other solutions. We need to make compromises in order to make it work. I know that that's not a ton of fun, but like, if Bitcoin's actually going to scale, like, it needs to scale in a high fee environment. It needs to scale when demand for the blockchain outpaces the capacity on the blockchain. But guess what happens there? There's this idea in Stoicism, it's the obstacle is the way. Like, high fees are the way to come up with better, more clever, more innovative ways to scale Bitcoin. And if the fees aren't high, then we're going to invest in solutions that might not actually scale, that might not actually work. And there's a lot of people now, they're second guessing Lightning as a panacea and Lightning as the ultimate scaling solution, because they're realizing every Lightning channel is a Bitcoin transaction at its heart. So it can only scale to the level of, you know, the base layer actually creating capacity. So, you know, you could say, hey, the Bitcoin community has been operating with 5 years with very, very low fees. And what do they have to show for it? They have no solutions that actually work in a high fee environment. So maybe we need a high fee environment so we can come up with solutions that actually work in a high fee environment. Like, you know, as a human rights advocate, you know, I don't even like to necessarily like categorize myself that way. I think all Bitcoiners are human rights advocates. And I think that, you know, I haven't been here for very long, but as someone who wants to see Bitcoin be a real solution, like, we need Bitcoin to actually work. There's a lot of nice solutions around how government should work, how the Constitution should work, how law should work in order to create this ideal world. But unless we can actually present solutions that stand the test of time, that stand pressure, that stand scale, it's not going to work in reality. Like, this is the difference between reality and narratives. Bitcoin just makes that painfully obvious because Bitcoin is, it doesn't BS. It's valid transaction on the blockchain or it's not, right? It's dust and is economically invalid or infeasible to spend, or it's not, right? It's these transactions work or they don't. So, you know, Bitcoin's a no fluff, no BS system. So, you know, I just think we have to grapple with that reality. And I think we need to develop tools that actually work, right? The HRF used to recommend Moon Wallet as a great way to have the benefits of on-chain security with interoperability with Lightning. And we used to give people cents on Moon Wallet. That is no longer viable. We need to find a different solution. And we're trying to fund those better and different solutions that are going to work in the high fee environment so we can continue that activity. But we're not going to waste our time recommending a solution that's not going to work and then have people be disappointed. And I'm personally a huge fan of Moon. It's an on-chain wallet that's interoperable with Lightning. But in a high fee environment, it's not going to give you cheap fees because it's ultimately on-chain transactions that have to compete with other on-chain transactions and pay you know, on-chain market rates.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bitbox. Now, Bitbox is a hardware wallet that's open source, incredibly secure and easy to use, and it's what I'm using to safely secure my Bitcoin in cold storage. Now, I know self-custodying Bitcoin can really be intimidating, but Bitbox is designed for ease of use without compromising on security. It's USB-C compatible and allows you to easily back up and restore your private keys with a micro SD card, which is really cool. Now, you can purchase the Bitbox using the promo code TPB at the link found in the show notes for 5% off your purchase. And I really want to thank Bitbox for their support of the podcast, and I'm really excited about this new partnership. All right, I'll let you get back to the episode now.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that was the first wallet I actually used getting into Bitcoin. And I think to your point, there are some solutions that are good for a specific date and time, or they're good for a few years, and then you have to adjust. You have to move on. You have to deal with things as they are, like you said, in reality with these things. And that is okay. I think, because I've seen so much trolling on just that specific topic, like, oh, they used to recommend Moon or something like that. Not in HRF's case, but just in general, maybe in HRF's case too. I'm like, yeah, that worked at that point in time. Stop acting like you know perfectly year in and year out, and you know for forever in the future that product would not be recommendable or something like that, right? You have to adjust on the fly, and it's not some scam product. It's just not the best way to operate with Lightning at the moment, right? Because of those fees. And I think too, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I don't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say, none of us know. We're just this, like, that's why recognizing how early we are, it gives you peace because you know it's not fully baked. I feel like a lot of people are operating again under kind of scenario number three, where they just kind of see Bitcoin as this fully baked or mostly baked solution. And, you know, most of those people turn into skeptics on a long enough time horizon. So I actually think it's very hopeful to acknowledge how early we are and how nascent this thing is. A lot of times people are like, oh, we've crossed the chasm. I think crossing the chasm is like 15% global adoption. Like, we're at 0.001% global adoption. And if your definition is not just like heard of crypto as adoption, but like holds their own keys, you know, we're even less than that. So we're very, very far away from crossing the chasm. And I would argue, like, we're in the very beginning of the early innovator stage. So, like, you know, if you look at like the innovation adoption bell curve, like, we're at the very, 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 very beginning. So I think obviously there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot to learn about this system, but there's also a lot to gain and there's a lot to improve. And, you know, we're just getting started. So I think that's very hopeful.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, I don't want to demonize a certain community or think about this too much, but I think there is some correlation. I'm just curious your thoughts, because I approach this, like I mentioned, from a sociology and human psychology worldview in terms of some of the loudest freedom maximalists have some of the toughest times getting out of that mental model to see what we're talking about in this conversation with what Bitcoin is, with valid transactions, what the network is, all of these things. So how can someone be so aware of that, I think, in their life or their or a particular worldview, but then to Bitcoin, approaching it as if it's not an anti-fragile system, as if it's the most fragile thing in the world that must be protected. Why do you think that's been such a tough time for certain folks?
Well, I mean, people aren't very good at breaking down their narratives and being humble to their worldview. Like, that's not just a Bitcoin thing. That's a humanity thing. I think, like, through the arc of history, that's just been the case. You know, I think ultimately we're these dumb, you know, animals running around this rock that's hurtling around the sun. And we're just trying to figure things out. I have a tattoo on my body. It pretty much, it's like my life motto, but the key of life is to know nothing. My mental, you know, kind of my mental model on the world is that, all the knowledge we have and we know is based off of our observations as a collective species from our perspective of the universe. And if you like zoom out to like our perspective of the universe, it's nothing, right? So everything we know is nothing, right? So in order to continue to move forward, like, you have to properly gauge what we already know, which is very, very, very little, and be open to, like, we can discover something that completely disproves what we know, but acknowledging that and being open to that will allow us to know more, right? And allow us to continue to gain. So, like, you know, I got that tattoo before even discovering Bitcoin. Like, that's how I've been viewing the world, you know, far before Bitcoin. But I think it really does apply to Bitcoin. And I think that there just needs to be a lot of humility to what we do and do not know within Bitcoin. And that's why I like to use like the developer example, right? The most advanced and most experienced developers in Bitcoin, maximum, and this is the very, very few of these developers even exist, have 14 to 15 years of Bitcoin development experience, right? Like, where we're going is we're going to have legacies of Bitcoin developers. Like, we know nothing yet about this system.
Yeah. And do you think that there are more, as you talk about kind of these generations of developers and things like that? Because that's one of the things I've made jokes here and there. I'm like, gosh, I feel like I need to like really dig in, learn how to code, because I'm really convicted about wanting to help these scaling solutions. But I feel like there's not as much development as could be and should be in Bitcoin and Bitcoin products and tools. And for better or for worse, I'm hoping that future bull markets and kind of a shift from, you know, the more we see crypto and shitcoin, you know, crashes, the more real investment and money, something that Bitcoiners might not like to talk about that much, will kind of come in and fund a lot of these projects that desperately need like legitimate funding besides just like zaps on Noster. Like, you know, that kind of level of funding. So do you think there's been any from developers, things like that have still been staying away from Bitcoin because they're like, that's just not me? You know, like, I feel like there is, right? Like, Ethereum has this pitch, I come and you build whatever, like it's build and burn fast with a lot of these shitcoin projects, and Ethereum being the more legitimate, what I would still call it, you know, shitcoin project people working on. Do you think like we've not done a good job of saying you can come and help build on Bitcoin, this is what it is, with some of these messages? And I don't want to overstate and I don't want to understate. You know what I mean? Like, some of these Twitter fights, right? They come and go.
Yeah, I think I can answer this. Well, I would say like Bitcoin is a really, really weird foreign thing. That's why it's a paradigm shift. Gunpowder was initially thought to be medicine. It turns out like that's definitely not the ultimate use case for gunpowder. So the fact that there is confusion around this thing is like almost proof that it is a foreign way of doing things that is not aligned with the current status quo of how the world operates. So I would say the fact that there's confusion, that people aren't necessarily jumping on it, is like, it's almost like proof of paradigm shift. Like, if it's a paradigm shift, like, by definition, the average person operating in today's paradigm isn't going to see it. Parker Lewis has an amazing quote. It's one of my favorite quotes about thinking about Bitcoin big picture, is that Bitcoin is counterintuitive, and then hyper intuitive. So the way that I like to like think about that is that everyone is operating on the current paradigm. Bitcoin's a new paradigm, and we have to bridge that gap. Like, and that's going to happen person to person. And even people who are like, I'm Bitcoin native now, most likely they're not. Most likely the best case scenario is that they have a foot in each kind of paradigm shift, or each kind of paradigm. Excuse my loose language there. So, you know, we're dealing with this really weird thing that we don't understand. So I would say, like, by definition, because we are this early and it is this weird and this much of a strange thing to us, like, we should expect that it's going to be difficult for people to move over. But with that being said, like, I think that that's also really optimistic, because like, that's not the forever for Bitcoin, right? Like, we're going to become more accustomed to Bitcoin. It's going to become something that is more trusted, that is more developed on, that is more built into what we're doing. And as the globe kind of moves from the current paradigm and they're bridging over to the new paradigm, not only is it going to become way, way, way more obvious, but the funding and the development and all that stuff is going to increase exponentially. That's why the adoption bell curve, or if you flip it over, the adoption S curve, like, it goes vertical at some point. So I'm saying we are at the very, very, very beginning of the S. And then when it becomes obvious to everyone, you know, obviously a lot of the gains have already been made, but we're going to go vertical, right? Like, it's actually obvious, right? So that's just how technology works. So I think that Bitcoin is going to operate like other technologies that have gone through that process.
Yeah, I agree with that. And we don't have a framing for it. I think that's the underlying message of this episode, is just like, we can't fully comprehend and anticipate that. But obviously, you know, let's get into it. You are one of the most bullish people in this space, just the way you talk about it, the things you're committed to. What are some of the things you're most excited about in Bitcoin, let's say for the next year, whether it's stuff you're seeing through HRF and the work you all are doing there, just your own knowledge coming from Bitcoin Magazine and seeing adoption through that lens, and, you know, ETFs and more normies coming into the space. There's a lot of, obviously on our end, we focus a lot on that environmental FUD. Like, we're fighting FUD all the time, because, you know, a lot of folks on the left and progressives, it's like 1% or even in Bitcoin are really understanding what we're talking about. So we're trying to have more of those conversations that other Bitcoiners just won't. And I'm like, that's fine. Like, we want to do that because that's just untapped potential. What are you most excited about in Bitcoin for this next year, do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you brought up the energy FUD. I personally think that the area that Bitcoin gets kind of mass adoption first is actually in energy generation. I think Bitcoin mining is such a massive shift forward in the economics of energy generation that it's actually going to be the catalyst for electrifying the whole planet. So if you were to think about money as a mental operating system that economies leverage to allocate resources, the current dollar system, effectively what it requires is that 70% of humanity lives in destitution, and a subset of that is completely unelectrified. So, like, the dollar operating system is unable to electrify the planet in ways that do not waste resources. Probably more than 50% of energy generated ends up being wasted. It's actually probably more than that. But the reality is that energy consumption and energy consumption in an efficient manner is directly correlated with human prosperity. So a lot of people on the left, they don't know anything about energy generation. Two, they don't appreciate the requirements for energy for humans to prosper. A lot of their strategies to save the planet also correlate with deindustrialization, the diminishing of people's lifestyles and quality of life. and steps back. And I would say is like, that's not a scalable strategy that is going to be adopted and will only lead to more derangement from the left around the realities of humanity and disappointment on the left and more throwing orange, you know, orange paint at famous paintings. Like that's derangement, y'all. Like that's a lack of a real strategy. So Bitcoin as a monetary system, unlike the dollar system, actually has the opportunity to create efficient energy generation and to bring that efficient energy generation to the planet. So I think a great example of this is Alex Gladstein's most recent article in Bitcoin Magazine talking about visiting gridless sites in Malawi, which is one of the least electrified countries in Africa. And Africa is one of the least electrified continents on the planet. So, you know, this is the bottom of the economic and energy generation world. And guess what? Those places are very green, but those people are also living really, really hard and difficult lives, and they're not productive, right? So how do we have the best of both worlds? How do we light, you know, give those people energy, give those people power in ways that make sense economically? Well, I think Bitcoin mining could do that. And so how does Bitcoin mining do that? Well, effectively what Bitcoin mining is a geographically neutral and geographically flexible energy buyer. So when you produce energy, producing the energy is just step one. Getting the energy and transporting energy is step two, and managing that grid, because the way that electricity grids work is the amount of energy created has to be equal to the amount of energy used. And that's why there's so much energy wasted, because of those things being out of whack. Well, pretty much what Bitcoin mining does is a flexible load to either take energy or to not take energy. And that is geographically independent. So what is created there is now you can have remote data centers anywhere on the planet that can be plugged into energy generation facilities to make them profitable on day one. And then those, that same load is flexible. It can be turned on and off without diminishing the Bitcoin product because it's distributed. And ultimately, that changes the economics of energy generation. And giving people more energy in ways that are less wasteful is good for humanity. And it's net better for the planet than doing it in an inefficient way, which is the way that is currently driven by the dollar system. So I'm very, very optimistic about what Bitcoin can do for humanity and for human progress and for the least, I would say like the least well-off people on the planet. And simultaneously, how it can help with the efficiency of our energy generation and hopefully be a real green and real efficient way for humanity to move forward without going backwards in terms of our lifestyles and our access to productivity and our access to energy.
Yeah, that's the most bullish message ever that you know we talk about all the time. And I think I try to mention it on here as well for folks that listen to, you know, stuff we talk about enough on this podcast or have connected with me. They kind of get past the progressive thing, right? And I think people have kind of seen why we call ourselves that, where we come from, and who we're trying to appeal to. And through this conversation, but also many others, we try to talk about like solutions over ideology, right? And I think once people get through that ideology, like climate activist friends I have, all of this, they start to understand, because I didn't know anything about energy generation. And then hearing Margot and Troy talk about this, I was like, oh, wow. Okay. And then I started to get really pissed off at some friends that wouldn't quite get there. And then took a step back. Let's be patient here, because there's not solutions in the things you said. Like, I'm going to be frank. I'm right there with you. There's not solutions in throwing paint on paintings. There's not solutions in certain protests. And you're demonizing Bitcoin, but Bitcoin has done more to electrify Africa than arguably the UN, or at least it will very soon.
I would say it already has.
Alex said that recently. Yeah, I would say too. I know some of this data is a little bit tricky, and I can, you know, page up my friend Daniel Baden and get some data on this. But you know, methane mitigation, at least Bitcoin mining is leading there.
Huge.
But I would agree with you.
Methane is a huge issue too. So methane mitigation, yeah. Very, very underrated, and we didn't even talk about that.
Right. And if you're an environmentalist and you are outright dismissing Bitcoin, I would say you don't care about solutions to addressing climate change or addressing electrification. Like you just don't. And we need to call a spade a spade. And I think a lot of the Bitcoin environmentalists have grown a lot more comfortable doing that because we have a lot of data to back us up now that we've been waiting for the past couple of years, but it's been coming through in full force the past year. So it's that tide is shifting and is super exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would say a lot of the, like, let's call it angry, upset environmentalists on the left that have no real solutions other than begging people to use less electricity are pretty similar to like the angry, upset Bitcoiners who are begging people not to do non-monetary transactions. Like, there's a similarity there. I think that we need to be solutions oriented. We need to be reality oriented. And ultimately, if you're an environmentalist and you don't understand energy generations and the economics of energy and the politics of energy and the realities of energy, how can you have solutions? You come up with really dumb things like, okay, let's do solar everywhere without even acknowledging the reality that solar can't be baseload, right? And then you make really, really dumb energy allocation decisions. And this is why I say, like, it comes down to the money. Like, this is a dollar-driven solution that doesn't work, right? And Bitcoin is all about reality. The economics of Bitcoin is all about reality. So I think Gladstein's pushing forward this idea now that not mining Bitcoin wastes energy, right? And I would push that even further, that not embracing Bitcoin and not embracing technology makes you not an environmentalist. So if you're a real environmentalist, you are focused on what matters because we don't have time and we need solutions and you need to understand how the grid works and you need to embrace technology in order to move forward in a scalable way. So that is the debate that we're currently experiencing globally. And I think that it's good that we're having the debate. And ultimately, it's going to lead to people wisening up and the people who are authentically actually care about the environment rather than narratives and social groups and galas and whatever else, you know, people LARPing prioritize, you know, they're going to align with reality, similar to yourself, similar to Daniel Batten, similar to Margo, similar to Troy. These are all people who deeply, deeply care about the reality of the environment. And they deeply, deeply care about the reality of energy, and they are aligning with reality, right? And that's why they're aligning with Bitcoin.
Yeah, last thing I'll say on that is I came to the conclusion of reality. I came into Bitcoin because I saw there was a problem to begin with. So you have to identify there's a problem with the current system to begin with. If you don't, if you think the solutions are only found in the current system, I'm not sure you're going to be ripe for wanting to understand or hear about Bitcoin. Secondly, I learned even before Bitcoin, I'm like, ExxonMobil isn't going to stop drilling for oil. You know what I mean? You can't just say, hey, please stop doing XYZ. There has to be game theory. There has to be incentives. There has to be, and again, there's so many different ways we can talk about what does government spending look like, this and that. But even for Bitcoin mining, it is not a government subsidized industry. One day it might be. The US government might buy like a shit ton of Bitcoin miners and start doing that, right? Like, hey, all for it, different ways. I mean, that's a more complex conversation. But you know, we face realities. We see the world as it is. We see corporations as they are. We see rich, greedy assholes as rich, greedy assholes that are still going to take the Trojan horse of Bitcoin. I could not agree more with that message. And I think we have to hammer home on that. So I hope, you know, people, you know, from the left, environmentalists that hear that and they're like, hey, you know, take a step back. Realize, why are Willy Woo? Why is Margo? Why are other people posting about global, like, rising water temperatures and ocean temperatures and also Bitcoin mining? Like, just take a step back. These people were environmentalists first and then saw Bitcoin as a solution. Like, that is real.
Yeah, I think it's going to become more and more obvious. And I think Bitcoin tightly correlating and aligning with energy production is like the first stage of hyper Bitcoinization and the first place that Bitcoin's going to have real, real product market fit. Right. So I'm not talking about, you know, false narratives around cheap payments or unbanking everyone on the planet or rebanking everyone on the planet and all this stuff. I'm talking about like this is a reality that is actually going to happen. And I think it's aligned with the trajectory is that the product market fit around Bitcoin miners as being the first and last buyer of energy and the implications of that is actually going to become super, super obvious. And then it's going to become a matter of dollars and cents, a matter of sats. Are you going to be an energy producer that is less competitive because you're more wasteful? Or are you going to be an energy producer that is more competitive and more profitable because you embrace technology and you become less wasteful with Bitcoin mining?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, CK, I think there's so much signal in this episode from you that I think people will really appreciate. I mean, I really appreciate just everything I've learned from you coming into this space, the support that you've given to me in this pod, and just other folks coming into this space that are trying to understand this paradigm shift and expand these narratives and things. And so just thank you for what you've been doing. Love the pivot to HRF. I was so excited for you when I saw that. So keep crushing it there. That's awesome. Before we jump off, anywhere you want to send people to, you know, we're going to put HRF links, especially these funds that people, and I've encouraged people to support those funds as well for developers and these Bitcoin funds that are radically transforming the world and projects around the world. We talk about Africa, a lot of developers and projects in Africa that HRF is supporting through this development fund. So please check that out in the show notes. But anywhere else you want to send people to?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one sec, I'm just going to pull up. I have a bunch of links. So I think the best place to learn about what I'm working on right now is hrf.org/financial-freedom. If you just go to hrf.org, click on our work, there's a tab that says programs, and then financial freedom is one of like 15 different programs. So HRF does a lot of stuff. But if you go onto the financial freedom page, you can see kind of a high level what we're about. You can see recent publications. That includes Gladstein's most recent article around stranded energy and how Bitcoin saves wasted energy and helps electrify people who were economically unable to do so. And then you can check out all of our initiatives. So the three that I really want to point out is one, the Bitcoin Development Fund. So if you are someone who is working on open source technology, working on Bitcoin education, or working on Bitcoin community efforts, especially in regions that are not democracies, please, please apply. We give $500,000 in grants every single quarter. We accept grants on a rolling basis and announce them at the end of each quarter. So we will be announcing our Q2 grants in June, but please apply. You know, don't ask, don't get. So, you know, if we say yes, you get funding from us in Bitcoin. If it's not a good fit, we'll let you know. If there's a chance that it could be a good fit, we're going to give you some feedback. Another thing to point you to is the Financial Freedom Report. Every single week, we put out what I believe is the highest signal, non-purely technical newsletter in Bitcoin. We cover financial freedom across the globe, as well as what is happening in Bitcoin. That hits your inbox every single Thursday, so you can subscribe at the HRF Financial Freedom page. And then lastly, I want to point people towards our CBDC tracker. So central bank digital currencies are kind of like this last narrative justifying fiat and government control over money. And they are being rolled out, deployed, and anticipated by almost every single central bank out there. So HRF is focusing on tracking that and trying to shine a light on what's happening there. And we update that on a rolling basis. So I believe in the past quarter, we updated like 35 of the different countries' progresses around central bank digital currencies. So that is a really fantastic resource. So Bitcoin Development Fund, Financial Freedom Report, CBDC Tracker, check that all out. We have other resources on there as well as other news and media around our work, but that all can be found on the hrf.org page. And if you like what I'm saying, if you want to support what HRF is doing, you can donate money to HRF in Bitcoin or in fiat.
Awesome. That was a good update. I follow all of those things religiously, and they're awesome resources that, again, whether you're a veteran in Bitcoin, whether you're brand new to the space, those initiatives are great places to start and just keep in touch with. So I definitely echo that. And I'll put all of that in the show notes as well. So people can, you know, if you hear it, great, and you remember it, but check out our show notes for that. CK, thank you. This was an awesome conversation. I appreciate you, and we'll do this again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Trey. And yeah, I had a great time. So thanks for letting me get on my soapbox.